You can read Christian History Magazine issue number 151, Awakenings, for free online at the link in the episode notes, or purchase your print copy. Visit ChristianHistoryInstitute.org to sign up for your free first-year subscription to Christian History Magazine and find more resources on the history of our faith.
Hi, you're listening to the Wayfinding Podcast. We are your hosts, Mark Draper and Joe Thomas. This podcast is brought to you by Life Together House. This is a podcast for those who think history matters. Here, we will listen to the lives of faithful Christians who have come before us as they help us find our way today as followers of Jesus Christ. We will walk together through the events, places, relationships that shape their lives, telling their story, learning from their witness, navigating our path in today's world. This is Season 2, Wayfinding on the Road to Revival.
What is revival? It's restoration. What is revival? It's waking up from sleep.
God sent His Son, Jesus Christ, to the cross to die for you.
Oh, brother, it's wonderful to be alive if you let Jesus come into your heart.
And that's a revival. You want to be part of it, don't you?
Revival, renewing the heart, revitalizing the church.
Welcome to the Wayfinding Podcast. We are continuing in our revival series in conjunction with the Christian History Institute and Christian History Magazine, which is doing a three-part series on the history of revivalism. This is part two, and this issue is called Awakenings. This issue is covering the first and the second Great Awakening in America. And I'm here with Dr. Mark Draper. He's going to be with us throughout this journey. He's part of our Wayfinding team. We're going to be talking about Jonathan Edwards and George Whitefield and up into the Second Great Awakening and just the amazing influence that it had on the history of the church, particularly the history of the church in the Anglo-American world. And so, Mark, you know, as we start to think about this outbreak of revival in the First Great Awakening, you start to really think of sort of three main characters.
The sort of a Mount Rushmore, if you only have three.
That's a good way to put it. We could probably find a fourth one. Then there's
we can look for a fourth one. Yeah,
Jonathan Edwards, which probably many of our listeners have heard of. A lot of times we think of him as the theologian. George Whitefield, we think of him as the preeminent evangelist of the Great Awakening, and John Wesley, who is the great organizer of the Great Awakening. All of those three have a part to play, a significant part to play in the Great Awakening, but they also help to sort of forge a new identity within Protestant Christianity that becomes known as evangelicalism.
Yeah, I really see them as sort of the founding fathers, as it were, of evangelicalism, what it will become in the 19th and 20th centuries. And yeah, this idea of convertive piety, such a big part of this, this idea of just because you're part of a church or you're in a state church doesn't mean you're okay. You still need to have this experience with God. In many ways, I think these men are products. I mean, Edwards is a Puritan, right? So, but they're certainly the products of Pietism that comes out of the 17th century, out of Lutheranism, and then, of course, Puritanism, as well as, and this will kick back to our earlier episode, the Pietism and the Puritans and some of these men were reading those medieval mystics who were we talked about in revival in our earlier episode. And so you can actually see a continuity, Joe. You can kind of see where believers in one century are going back, reading believers from another century, saying, how do I have this experience of God?
One thing that seems to be changing, though, in the broader culture is we're moving from thinking about yourself as part of a collective or a large family. And we're starting to see the emergence of individualism appear during this time period. And that has a lot to do with the sort of revivals we start to have and our understanding of conversion. Conversion starts to change from you're sort of part of a collective, part of a church, part of a family, to now it's the individual. It's interesting to think about conversion amongst the Puritans and amongst the German Pietists because it starts to really shape how people start to think about their own intimacy, their own relationship with God moving forward.
Yeah, it's almost the fallout of the priesthood of all believers, the doctrine from the Reformation, and it's going to morph into new ways, a new way of thinking about my individual salvation. And also, too, when you and I were in Erfurt and we learned about how back in the Middle Ages, when you wanted to dedicate your life to God, you joined the monastery. Obviously, there were lay ways of having devotion, too. But there was this is post-Reformation, so there aren't any monasteries to go join. This really is the way the priesthood of all believers is going to be lived out. And so you're going to see this. You'll see individual piety. I mean, the Puritans had a belief, right? Every home should be a little monastery. And then, of course, we're going to see the birth of interdenominational programs together to build. You don't have to do that in the Middle Ages. There are no denominations. It's just Catholic.
It's interesting with the German pietists particularly, you start to see this social consciousness. Governments are not taking care of the orphans.
No.
And we start to see within German pietism, and this flows into early evangelicalism, this idea that we have a responsibility for the least of our folks in our community. And so orphanages start to be created and built up, and ways in which to help the poor sort of make it through the tough times. Maybe we can focus on Jonathan Edwards first and that first kind of the spark almost of the Great Awakening in Northampton, Massachusetts, yeah. Where he's a pastor and he's taken over for his grandfather, Solomon Stoddard.
The Pope of New England.
The Pope of New England, who's had kind of some mini revivals themselves over his career. So again, this is something that's sort of growing. It's not just starting from someplace brand new, but maybe tell us, you know, Edwards is one day gets up in the pulpit. He preaches on justification by faith.
Yes.
And something amazing happens.
And Edwards is not really a great preacher. Whitfield can bring it. Edwards would read his sermons, but his sermon on justification by faith resonated with people at a time where there does seem to be a lull in piety within among Puritans, which makes sense. It's about 100 years since they've come from England and about third generation, and they don't have the same fervor that their great-grandparents or grandparents had when they were on the ships. And yeah, it's just something remarkable happens. People start having experiences of God, start converting, giving their lives over to God. And the big piece, too, I think in this one is that when you do this in Puritan New England, you're now, you've joined the church, you're not under the authority of the church. And so most people would try to avoid that sometimes until they wanted their kids baptized. But so what was very interesting about this revival is that young people in their teens and 20s who didn't need to necessarily come up with a conversion story to become a member so their kid could get baptized are freely converting and having these experiences of God. And I think what you said was really good. Puritans anticipated revival. They expected it. It was a tradition within that stream that you would have periodic revivals. Same way with Presbyterians in Scotland. And they look different, but you would have them. So it wasn't necessarily out of the ordinary, but it did really catch Edwards off guard a little bit, right? He was literally surprised by it and could see something really happening. Of course, he gets very excited about this. He sees and writes this amazing book, The Faithful Narrative, that, as you said, it's Anglo-American, so it's going to get published in America. It's going to get published in England. And even we find out John Wesley gets a copy.
Wesley and Whitfield, the Holy Club, they're a group of young Christians who've been meeting together, seeking God, seeking not only personal redemption, but seeking to reform the church. And they read this faithful narrative, and Wesley says, it started. They recognized immediately that what was happening over America was a move of God, and it's what they'd been praying for several years.
Remember, even the theological divide's going to begin because Wesley will edit the faithful narrative to get the Calvinist stuff out. Even there, right, that Arminian-Calvinist divide is still kind of, it's there in a way.
Absolutely, which is going to be Whitfield's great sort of gift to the church is that he's able to bridge that. But it's fascinating because Edwards is using the technology of the day, and this is something that we've seen in all the history of revivalism. And we'll see moving forward even more as new technologies develop, new capacities develop. We are now living in a transatlantic world in the early 1700s.
Yeah.
George Whitfield, Ben Franklin are going back and forth across the Atlantic on a semi-regular basis.
Correct.
Things that are unheard of. And also the publishing industry is able now to carry those books across. And so even a few decades before, that would not have been possible for Wesley, Whitfield, the Holy Club to get their hands on a book like this at such a distance. Yeah. And in the moment, it would have been years later when they would have seen it. And in that faithful narrative, it's very interesting because Edwards talks about some interesting phenomenon that happens within these revivals that really come to shape our understanding of revivalism and the Great Awakening and the Second Great Awakening and later 19th century birth of Pentecostalism.
Or what they would have called enthusiasm. The critics call it enthusiasm.
Yeah, what we think of as a good thing today, we want you to be enthusiastic. The critics of that day see it as you've lost your reason.
Mm-hmm.
You've given over yourself to just pure emotion.
Right.
And you're an enthusiast.
If you think of Edwards' book, this is an apologetic for the revival saying, no, it's not that, right? It's not just that. There's more to this. So, and this is, I think, what makes Edwards stand out is he is an intellectual.
Right.
He operates in that way. He's, you know, he's dealing with abstract philosophy in his treatises and his books. At the same time, he's writing materials about spiritual experience that sound like something from Azusa Street, which generally don't go together. And I think that's one of the things that makes Edwards so fascinating.
It is. I especially like the way he puts it together when he says that there's nothing wrong with this demonstrative behavior, but don't mistake it for conversion necessarily. Conversion is borne out by how the person is changed, transformed, and lives their life going forward. I've always thought that was a really healthy sort of connection between those two. There's nothing wrong with it. You might expect it in revivals, but don't confuse it that this is conversion itself. That will be borne out as people move forward. Mark, what's some of the demonstrative behavior that we see?
Yeah, I've had the luxury of working in Philadelphia and having access to 18th century newspapers. And one time I worked in a department where I could just read those. And you can read some of these accounts of experiences people are having in the First Great Awakening. And it would be, I felt electricity running through my body. I felt an uncontrollable passion in my heart.
The Spirit of God began extraordinarily to work amongst us. There were, very suddenly, one after another, five or six persons who were, to all appearance, savingly converted, and some of them wrought upon in a very remarkable manner. Jonathan Edwards.
There's one section of Edwards' works that covers the Great Awakening where he just describes this person who has almost like a three-week spiritual experience, and he talks about them having raptures, and he doesn't really explain those, but it's sort of this three-week mental, emotional, spiritual bliss of experiencing God. And we find out later he's actually writing about his wife. I mean, you're like, wow. And so as a teacher, sometimes I actually have the Reformed students and the Charismatic students read this section. I'm like, okay, this is the water we swim in. Edwards is not someone he would expect to have. I mean, it does. It sounds like an Azusa Street experience or a holiness revival in the frontier experience more than this academic Puritan. It just doesn't seem like that, but it is. And he's very much open to that. And so I think one of the things we want to pull out too is that for the Puritans, for the First Great Awakening, they're okay with a little mysticism. They're not so cerebral that there's not space for mystery and the presence of the Spirit and moving you in that way. And to some extent too, like having such a spiritual experience that I actually can see Jesus. I have a view of God. You start to hearken back to that beatific vision from the Middle Ages. You see that as well. And so it's just remarkable. But when you read these stories of what these people experienced, you're like, wow. I mean, they're just telling you, like, I literally felt like electricity was running through my body. I couldn't move, or I was in absolute despair over my soul. Now, there's a dark side to this too, because we'll see a story in New England where there will be a gentleman who actually commits suicide because he's not having this emotive, convertive experience.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things you see in revivalism, if we're trying to give a balanced account, is that not only are these amazing stories of God working, but there are people who run off into heresy.
Yep.
There are people who run off into doing bizarre things.
Yep.
And then there are people who have these sort of reactions that you're talking about.
Yep.
But When you think about conversion, I think of John Wesley as such a great example of kind of a quintessential conversion story as we're thinking about this time. Here's a young man of the Anglican Church. His father's a pastor, and he has grown up through this process. His mom is famously this great, organized, kind of moralist in a way. John Wesley is this person who's in the Anglican Church. He goes to Oxford. He's with this other group that eventually gets nicknamed the Holy Club. They're pursuing God. And the interesting part is they don't really know God yet in this intimate, personal way that revivals start to bring out. And so Wesley, while they're having just amazing prayer times and even ecstatic experiences, he ends up going to the New World and there finds that he is ill-equipped for what he's doing. On the boat ride over, a big storm blows up, and he sees a group of Moravians who are praying and seemingly without any kind of fear, praying on the deck as the storm is blowing around him. And he writes in his journal that he is totally fearful, and he finds this attraction. It's like, what do they have that I don't have? And he gets to the New World, and there, one of the Moravian leaders by the name of Spangenberg has a dialogue, has a discussion with him.
On the new birth.
On the new birth.
My brother, I must first ask you one or two questions. Have you the witness within yourself? Does the Spirit of God bear witness with your spirit that you are a child of God? I was surprised and knew not what to answer. He observed it and asked, do you know Jesus Christ? I paused and said, I know he is the Savior of the world. True, he replied. But do you know he has saved you? He only added, do you know yourself? I said I do, but I fear they were vain words. John Wesley.
Wesley comes out of this with the recognition that he's missing something. And he ends up going back to England and he goes to this local sort of religious society. He's invited there by a Moravian, and the Moravians were very, you know, big about you need to have a new birth. And he goes into it and he famously again tells us in his journal that he walks in, and when he walks in, they're reading from the preface of Martin Luther's commentary on Romans dealing with justification by faith. I find it fascinating how often this justification by faith part comes up. And Wesley tells us what? Mark, this is one of your favorite sayings from John Wesley.
My heart grew strangely warm.
And what did he mean by that?
It's a similar thing that you get from Edwards. You'll get this from a guy named Nathan Cole in America, where he talks about a heart wound. There's this idea that internally there's a peace. I'm finally saved. I can accept this. I am part of God's family. There's a higher level than just a mental assent. And I think that happens sometimes in confessional churches where it's like, well, of course I'm a good Anglican. I use the Book of Common Prayer every week. Of course I'm a good Puritan. I subscribe to the Westminster Confession, and you can go on and on and on with that. I marvel at this story. And you and I have been to Oxford. We've walked these streets where these Holy Club men were having these experiences. But I teach undergrad students. These are guys who are 20-somethings, right? And I teach 20-somethings. And when I teach this story at a Bible college to Christian kids, I said, how many of you are going back to your dorm room reading books, being concerned about your holiness? It's crazy, right? You think like, here are these men, they're reading books because they're concerned about, am I holy? In some ways, what you see there, Joe, is you see God sort of stirring them, preparing a Wesley for the trip to America on the ship. So in other words, the conversion was slow. There was a process. You could argue maybe it began when they're reading Henry Scogel. Then they have some experience, and then they have the moment. And I think what's really important too with this is that this conversion story of Wesley's, Edwards, when we get into the 19th century, this becomes almost a model of what you are to expect to have a conversion story. And so much of the evangelical story and DNA is, well, when did you have your conversion experience? Yeah.
You can read Christian History Magazine issue number 151, Awakenings, for free online at the link in the episode notes, or purchase your print copy. Visit ChristianHistoryInstitute.org to sign up for your free first-year subscription to Christian History Magazine and find more resources on the history of our faith. the center of what revivalism is yeah. trying to help lead people into this new birth experience. So it's interesting if with Edwards, what is happening is within the church in England, when Wesley and Whitfield, as they have come to faith, they've had this conversion experience, they now realize that trying to be holy on your own steam isn't going to get you there. Mm. You need God to intervene in your life. That's a new message. It's the message of the new birth that they are eager then to go out and to start preaching. Unlike in America, as they go into these Anglican churches, it doesn't take too long before they get kicked out.
Yep.
They're being enthusiasts.
Yes.
So that's a problem. B, they tend to be critical of the local Anglican priest. So they're not only not invited back, they're like, don't ever come back.
Right.
Yeah. And so it's really, really interesting. They get kicked out of the church. And this is something that we see as a hallmark of revivalism so often.
Yep.
Is that people get kicked out of the church and they are then pushed to where the actual people are. Because your miners, your laborers, your blue-collar people in England are not going to church. And so the revival is not going to happen in the church. The revival has to happen outside. And this pushing into where the people are, where they're working, into the meadowlands, changes the whole dynamic of this revival.
And what's fascinating is Whitfield takes to this like a duck to water. He loves this. Wesley, this is hard. He's a churchman. You know, he's a good Anglican. And just to go preach in a coal mine or preach in a field, it took some time for him to get to that space. We see this even in the States, where when we watch George Whitfield, when he comes to Philadelphia, he comes to Boston, he's not preaching in the churches. He's not allowed in the churches. He's preaching in the middle of the street, in the market, in the parks, Boston Common, places like that. It pushes it out. And as you have said in our conversations, what it does is it actually allows for more people to actually hear the gospel. I mean, 20,000 people at a pop and things like this.
The effects produced in Philadelphia at that time by the preaching of Mr. Whitfield were truly astonishing. Numbers of almost all religious denominations, and many who had no connection with any denomination, were brought to inquire with the utmost earnestness what they should do to be saved. Multitudes went to listen to spiritual instruction and public worship frequently, twice a day, for the space of a year, and on the Lord's Day, it was celebrated generally thrice, and frequently four times. So great was the zeal and enthusiasm to hear Mr. Whitfield preach that I and many from the city followed him on foot to Chester, to Abingdon, to Neshaminy, and some even to New Brunswick in New Jersey, the distance of 60 miles. Hannah Harcum Hodge.
It's fascinating how by being pushed out of the church, it creates this. And I think this gets back to a hallmark of revivalism that's in these issues, is that it's always going to create some tension, right? You had a great line that I want you to unpack a little bit, that revivals is where hierarchy goes to die. Because it does. It's very democratic in that way. It's very much that sort of, like we say, priesthood of all believers. And people are out in the fields and they're hearing a sermon and no one's charging them to go to it. They don't have to buy a pew.
One of Whitfield's most famous sermons is where he talks about it's not the denomination that you're a part of. It's being a Christian that gets you into heaven.
Father Abraham, are there any Anglicans in heaven? The answer came back, no, there are no Anglicans in heaven. Father Abraham, are there any Methodists in heaven? No, there are no Methodists in heaven. Are there any Presbyterians in heaven? No, there are no Presbyterians here either. What about Baptists or Quakers? No, there are none of those here either. Father Abraham, what kind of people are in heaven? The answer came back, there are only Christians in heaven, only those who are washed in the blood of the Lamb. Whitfield then cried out, oh, is that the case? Then God help me, God help us all to forget having names and to become Christians in deed and in truth. George Whitfield.
This sort of transdenominationalism or interdenominationalism or even perhaps even non-denominationalism becomes a hallmark, particularly under Whitfield's preaching. Wesley kind of continues to be a good churchman, and the Methodist movement is happening within it. His hope is that it will revive the Anglican church, just like Luther was hoping to revive the Catholic church.
Right.
Probably could argue that Edwards is trying to revive Puritanism sure. in New England. Whitfield seems a little more comfortable with the idea that he's just out there trying to bring people to the new birth experience,
right,
and the others can organize it.
He makes less of doctrines that our American preachers generally do and aims more at affecting the heart. He is a born orator. You have already heard of his deep-toned, yet clear and melodious voice. It is perfect music. It is wonderful to see what a spell he casts over an audience by proclaiming the simplest truths of the Bible. I've seen upwards of 1,000 people hang on his words with breathless silence, broken only by an occasional half-suppressed sob. Sarah Edwards.
There is sort of a proto-Calvinist Methodist denomination that starts to develop around Whitfield, but the way you said it, it doesn't really go anywhere.
No, he's not
an organizer like Wesley. It just sort of falls apart. And in even Edwards, he's not going to really start a new group, but there will be this Edwardsian movement of people who have studied with him who will kind of create a movement later after he dies. Where you do see this with Edwards is Edwards is actually asked to be the president of the College of New Jersey. Well, what is that? Well, that's a college that's started by the New Light, New Side Presbyterians in Philadelphia. These are the revivalist Presbyterians led by people like Gilbert Tennant coming from the Law College, and they start their own college and ask Edwards to be the president. Of course, he dies and he doesn't actually get to serve that out. But what you see in this is even in the States, new wineskins are created, new institutions are created, new colleges. And so what you have in the Presbyterian situation is they're going to split between this New Light, Old Light. But then when they come back together about 10, 15 years later, well, now they're all going to go to Princeton, right? They're all going to be part of that. And it becomes part of the fabric of the group. There's a time when there's a schism that's going on in the 18th century. And of course, Presbyterians like the schism. You could do a whole book on that. But that's the point, right? It is that it's going to create this tension because, like you said, the hierarchy of the church, they don't know what to do with this.
As well as I am able, I will describe it. Of all ages, from 8 years and upwards, male and female, rich and poor, the blacks and of every denomination, those in favor of it, as well as those at the instant in opposition to it and railing against it, have instantaneously laid motionless on the ground. Colonel Robert Patterson.
Well, this is one of the great paradoxes of revivalism. In the moment, revivalism really is unifying.
Yeah.
Like you said, you know, hierarchy goes to die and everybody kind of comes together. Everybody's on equal footing before the cross. But once revivalism starts to peter out, and typically it only goes a year, a couple years, 3 years perhaps, then you start to see the reemergence of theological traditions and, you know, denominations or different kinds of Christian movements that are birthed out of it. And so it's a sort of unity and then later disunity,
yeah,
because it creates division.
Let me ask you a question, Joe. Can you tell me the perfect revival where none of this stuff happened? Everybody kind of linked arms, you know, and started a church where everybody loved each other and they lived happily ever after. I mean, I think that's the story people want to hear, but is there a perfect revival?
Of course not. And in fact, in my book on Holiness Pentecostalism, which deals with a lot of revivals, I named the book Perfect Harmony because it comes from a quote from a lady who's at a revival and she sees this amazing unity and harmony that's going on. But the truth is that the birth of Pentecostalism causes great strife and division. So this is common. And we shouldn't be surprised by this. We should not be thinking that revivalism brings about utopia in the church. It does not. It brings about renewed hearts in the lives of people and changed lives. People start going a different path. And there are going to be people who are opposed to the methodology, who are opposed perhaps even to the theology, for sure opposed to a lot of the demonstrative behavior that we've been talking about. But you still get to see the fruit of revivalism, which is these changed lives, which then change the future trajectories of those people, their families, the churches they're a part of. And so there's great fruit, but there's also always division. There's people who take it to excess. You have all these sorts of things. You know, with Whitfield, I mean, you see this because he's such a phenomenon that it's hard to wrap your mind around. Even today, You know, it's a hard to imagine you go to the Boston Commons and there would be 20,000 people showing up to listen to one person. By the way, what a voice this guy must have had to project out and hear everyone be able to hear him, which we know, by the way, is true because the skeptic Ben Franklin actually is at some of his revival preaching.
Measures it out.
And measures it out in Philadelphia. Yeah. And you get a sense of the excitement from accounts we have, particularly one from Nathan Cole.
Yes.
Now it pleased God to send Mr. Whitfield into this land, and my hearing of his preaching at Philadelphia, like one of the old apostles, and many thousands flocking to hear him preach the gospel, and great numbers were converted to Christ, I felt the Spirit of God drawing me by conviction, longed to see and hear him, and wished he would come this way. Then one morning, all on a sudden, about 8 or 9 o'clock, there came a messenger and said, Mr. Whitfield preached at Hartford and Wethersfield yesterday and is to preach at Middletown this morning, October 23rd, 1740, at 10 of the clock. I was in my field at work. I dropped my tool that I had in my hand and ran home and ran through my house and bade my wife get ready quick to go and hear Mr. Whitfield preach at Middletown and to run my pasture for my horse with all my might, fearing that I should be too late to hear him. I brought my horse home and soon mounted and took my wife and went forward as fast as I thought the horse could bear. And when my horse began to be out of breath, I would get down and put my wife on the saddle and bid her ride as fast as she could and did not stop or slack for me except I bade her. And so I would run until I was much out of breath and then mount my horse again. And so I did several times to favor my horse. We improved every moment to get along as if we were fleeing for our lives, all the while fearing we should be too late to hear the sermon. When I saw Mr. Whitfield come upon the scaffold, he looked almost angelical, a young, slim, slender youth before some thousands of people with a bold, undaunted countenance. In my hearing how God was with him everywhere as he came along, it solemnized my mind and put me into a trembling fear before he began to preach. For he looked as if he were clothed with authority from the great God, and a sweet, solemn solemnity sat upon his brow. And my hearing him preach gave me a heart wound. By God's blessing, my old foundation was broken up, and I saw that my righteousness would not save me. Then I was convinced. Farmer Nathan Cole.
And so, you know, with Whitfield, it's a phenomenon that's even greater than we see with Edwards or Wesley. In a way, it's a harbinger, I think, of the revivalism that is to come.
Yeah.
In part, you know, he's an amazing speaker. In part, they're starting to bring in some techniques. You know, how do you advertise a revival? You know, so he sort of creates the method going forward in the particularly the Anglo-American world. George Whitfield has this really interesting relationship with Ben Franklin.
It does not seem to make any sense. Because when you grow up in Philadelphia, you can't miss Franklin. He's everywhere. He's the inventor. He's this. And then you had the luxury of taking a class in college just looking at Franklin in the 18th century context. And you find out he's, on the one hand, he's this brilliant inventor and thinker, but he's a player as well. he's not exactly going to church every week. In fact, he'll actually, in his autobiography, he'll say he'd rather spend time studying than be bored at Presbyterian church hearing doctrine. But he likes Whitfield. You even wrote a play on this.
I did. There's actually a letter where he's writing back to his son because his son has just told him in a letter to him, to Franklin, that he saw Whitfield in Boston. And so Franklin is writing back to his son and says all these wonderful things about Whitfield and everything he loves about him and basically says, you know, tell him hi for me. And then at the end he says, and I love him. I love him. This is very passionate language for someone like Ben Franklin, you know, who is a very astute, almost sort of a worldly wise type of guy, you know, builds himself up from nothing and creates this empire, really, a publishing empire, which he and Whitfield work together on. He's the publisher of Whitfield's sermons, his journal, some of his other types of work that he's doing. And in some ways, Whitfield helps Franklin become a prosperous man that allows him now the luxury to do the things that we know he does, like science and the birth of the new country. So Whitfield is amazing. Big crowds, individuals. He's got something that no one else has. And I think this sets up, a lot of historians think of Whitfield's work as sort of unifying the country as we're moving towards the revolution. Our listeners should think about America as 13 individual colonies, all had their own governments, all were distinctive in many ways. And more historians are understanding that Whitfield's revivals, because he goes up and down the colony seven times preaching, that he helps forge this sort of new identity that you are Americans, not Virginians, not Carolinians. You're not your state, your colony, rather. You are Americans, and this is going to pay dividends as we start to move towards the revolution.
Yeah. If our listeners haven't read the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, it is a worthwhile read. But imagine, you know, Franklin, who's going to become the Postmaster General, he's going to be involved in the Continental Congress, all these things in shaping the new nation. But when he sits down to write his autobiography, he actually feels like he needs to tell you more about Whitfield and even how Whitfield's ability to preach could even shake Franklin down to give money to a donation.
I happened soon after to attend one of his sermons, in the course of which I perceived he intended to finish with the collection, and I silently resolved he should get nothing from me. I had in my pocket a handful of copper money, 3 or 4 silver dollars, and 5 pistoles, Spanish coins, and gold. As he proceeded, I began to soften, and concluded to give the coppers. Another stroke of his oratory made me ashamed of that, and determined to give the silver. And he finished so admirably that I emptied my pocket wholly into the collector's dish, gold and all. Ben Franklin.
One of our sort of wayfinding cues to take away from this first great awakening is the impact of preaching.
Yeah.
You know, so often we don't talk enough about that, but it's amazing its role in this first great awakening.
It's the preaching, and also I think something that shouldn't be missed either is the role of literacy. How many people were reading Whitfield's sermons, reading accounts of his revivals, because someone like Franklin was writing these and shipping these out. And I think the other piece of this too is it's not just that Franklin's actually defending Whitfield from those people who said he's an enthusiast, he's a scammer, he's this. And so even if you're not a religious person, but you may subscribe to the Pennsylvania Gazette, you're going to hear about this and you're going to hear positive things from the media on this revivalist preacher. That has to play huge dividends in how Americans now are starting to view Whitfield.
From being thoughtless or indifferent about religion, it seemed as if all the world were growing religious, so that one could not walk through the town in an evening without hearing psalms sung in different families of every street. Ben Franklin.
Yeah, and that leads into the revolution, which really does create this sort of identity as Americans now. You're not just a colony of England. And we move past that into the late 18th and now into the 19th century. And you start to see this growth of populism, particularly when we get to Andrew Jackson and Jacksonian democracy, which is a very much a populist movement. And we start to see out of this the birth of another awakening that happens. Not that revivalism stopped between the first and the second Great Awakening, but it's more like surges. More like maybe thinking about like an ocean has waves and you have small waves. There's still small waves that are going on, but then the big wave comes again.
Yes.
And that's what the second great awakening is. And it's born, I think, in many ways out of this new context. And this is really great, I think, the way the Holy Spirit works is that you have these great contexts of cultural changes and there's still ways in which the gospel is presented that meets people where they're at. And I think this populist turn impacts the way the Second Great Awakening plays out.
Yeah, I mean, if you could categorize the First Great Awakening in America, it's more Calvinistic, it's more Reformed. But the Second Great Awakening will be definitely more free will, Arminian, Wesleyan. And what's interesting is that, so we talk about the way revivals reshuffle the deck of groups and denominations, but the revolution did as well. because the big dogs, the big denominations who are going to come out of the revolution are the Baptists and the Methodists. And they're mobile, especially the Methodists are mobile. Here in Lancaster County, I was in a basement of a Methodist archive, and I found something that I never knew existed. It was a foldable, collapsible pulpit for the back of the horse, because this is how these Methodist itinerants would storm. There's a great book by John Wigger on this called Taking Heaven by Storm. I love that title. Just gives you a picture of how these Methodist itinerants are going into the new world and even going into places that haven't even been settled yet and bringing the gospel there, which if you don't make that move that Whitfield does to go outside in the fields, that never happens. We're recording this in Lancaster, PA. I could drive you, Joe, probably 5-10 minutes to camp meetings that still exist for Methodist and various Wesleyan groups. That whole concept of a camp meeting, of having some sort of, I don't know, Christian Woodstock outside doesn't happen without a Whitfield. And now here we are in 2024, and in a couple months, when the warmer months, Methodists and Wesleyans will be going to camp meeting, expecting revivals for salvation and holiness, and they do it every year.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm coming from Illinois, and one of Abraham Lincoln's competitors in a political race was a former Methodist itinerant preacher. I mean, that gives you the reach.
When we get to the famous Lincoln-Douglas debates and just the way politicians will even start to engage, they learn from these revival preachers and they start to engage politically. They're using the methods in some way. So imagine people sitting outside listening to Lincoln and Douglas debate for hours. People have already kind of become accustomed to that sort of thing because of these camp meetings and outdoor revivals.
Preach as if you had seen heaven and its celestial inhabitants and had hovered over the bottomless pit and beheld the tortures and heard the groans of the damned. Methodist bishop and circuit rider Francis Asbury.
And most people think of the Second Great Awakening starting with the Cane Ridge Revival.
Yeah.
This is unique. It's out on the frontier, and it becomes a place where people are gathering. In some ways, we're thinking about it as something that goes back to the Scottish, where they'd have a big communion service. Yep. and these sorts of things. But it breaks out of that fold. I mean, this is one of the interesting things about revivals, right? It breaks out of the church constructs, if you will, that we've created. It's always breaking out of the confines and flowing in unexpected ways. And Cane Ridge is one of those unexpected ways, because we start to see multiple, and this is sort of the frontier in itself, these big camp meetings on the frontier. You'll have Methodists and Baptists and people coming from different denominational backgrounds all at the same camp meeting, preaching around the camp meeting. Again, this is what we were talking about earlier, this sense of unity within the revival, even if it doesn't last outside of the river. Like there's something when the big wave comes in,
yeah,
it does create a sort of unity. But Cane Ridge, tell us a little bit about Cane Ridge, because there, again, you see this demonstrative behavior emerge.
The Cane Ridge Revival, because it's happening on the frontier versus on the coasts, is going to have such a different flavor, because the frontiers people, the frontiersmen and women, they're not Harvard, Yale type people. These are people who are pull yourself up by your bootstraps, trying to survive on the frontier, and in some cases, going into real estate that the government's not even sanctioning you to live in. It's still native country. Some of these people are actually like squatters, but it's a rough kind of tough sort of rough and tumble kind of lifestyle to do this. And so the gospel presented to them in this more you choose, you know, you decide resonates with them, because they have to make hard decisions every day just to survive. So it takes on a different flavor, right? There's dancing, there's rolling around, there's stuff that would never happen in the Boston Common or up on the Harvard Yard, right? This is regular folk.
On the 1st of May, 1801, at a society on the waters of Fleming Creek, a boy under the age of 12 years became affected in an extraordinarily manner, publicly confessing and acknowledging his sins, praying for pardon through Christ, and recommending Jesus Christ to sinners as being ready to save the vilest of the vile. Adult persons became affected in the like manner. The flame began to spread. The Sabbath following, at Mr. Campbell's meeting house, a number became affected. third Sabbath of May on Cabin Creek, 6 miles above Limestone, the sacrament of the Lord's Supper was administered and about 60 persons were struck down. Colonel Robert Patterson.
It takes off, right? You have multiple denominations part of it. But what's fascinating is, and to go back to your point, oftentimes these revivals will create new groups. Then they'll have to be revived. Now, the one thing I want us to tease out, but I'm going to pitch it back to you because this is something you've talked a lot about. When I look at Cane Ridge, I think, particularly with the Christian church and the movements, there really is this sort of primitivism, restorationism that comes out of this. Can you unpack that a little bit? Because that's such an important component to understanding, I think, American religion.
Yeah, I mean, you really see this emerge in the Second Great Awakening. Yeah. And it's this idea of getting back to the first century church, the New Testament church, becomes a very dominant idea moving forward for the next 100 years, if not longer, in American Christianity and revivalism for sure. And it's this sense of going back to the New Testament, going back to the book of Acts, and looking at what the church was like then. And then people are reading, you're talking about literacy earlier, right?
Yeah.
People are reading the Bible for themselves and they're looking around, they're saying, this doesn't look like what I'm reading in the New Testament. And it opens them up to this sort of, should we be experiencing the things that we read in the book of Acts?
Yes.
Or in Paul's letters, he talks about different churches, that sort of thing. And so this mindset, we call it now restorationism, was how do we restore the first century church?
Yeah.
And for so many on the American frontier, they're not credo Christians. They're not creeds or, I mean, the Methodist, yes. But even there, it's such a blend of revivalism and the credoism there. You know, the Bible becomes the creed. If the Reformers talked about sola scriptura,
yeah,
you know, the Bible alone, this really comes to full manifestation in 19th century frontier America. The Bible is where we're standing, and we want to emulate the first century church.
Yeah. It's funny. We have this political term today, MAGA, Make America Great Again. This group is sort of Make the Church Acts Again, the MACA Christians. And there's this idea that somehow we can go back to that. And if we could just get away from everything that happened in the Middle Ages and the Reformation and just get back to Acts, that we'll finally get it right. That was where the ideal revivals took place. And that was the ideal church. And that thread of can we get back, can that primitivism or restoration, just tracks through so many religious movements, even all the way down to say something like Jehovah's Witness, right? Where, again, you're reading the Bible for yourself. I don't see the word Trinity. That mentality of, one, I can read the Bible for myself, and can we get back to something better? Can we make it better? And I think the American experiment's a big part of that because they already saw themselves as
something new.
Something new, and in some ways, doing what the old guard couldn't do. And in this regard, it's like, well, you know what? The old guard's not just bad politically, they're also bad ecclesiastically. And can we get back to our roots?
And the old guard is on the East Coast. We're the adventurers who are going west, which is also just a certain sort of person. You know, it's interesting because you see this awakening also flow into unexpected places like the African-American Free Church,
yep,
the African-American who have been enslaved.
Yes.
And you see the beginning of revivalism there. In fact, a lot of historians think that there was a lot of cross-pollinization that was happening. And sometimes, of course, in the South particularly, a master may come with his slaves, and the slaves would participate in the revival as well. So here's a part of that. You know, revivalism is where hierarchy goes to die until you leave the revival. You're back in, quote unquote, the real world. Nonetheless, there is this emergence of a black church that,
yes,
starts to happen at this time.
Yeah, and this is a story I love. Richard Allen, again, I'm a Philly guy. I love Philly history. I'm actually sitting here in my Eagles sweatshirt, and so I breathe and I love Philadelphia. But there's this great story about Richard Allen. Richard Allen was a slave in Delaware. This is after the Revolution, across the river from Philadelphia. And lo and behold, itinerant Methodist preacher preaching in the fields in Delaware where anybody can hear it, including this slave, Richard Allen. And he has a conversion experience. There's something about the way this Methodist is presenting the gospel. And I do think in the early part, the anti-slavery bent of people like John Wesley came through in the Methodist message. So Richard Allen hears the gospel, gets saved, and has this idea, if my master could hear this preacher, he would probably let me go free. And so he arranges for the itinerant pastor to come back and make sure that his master's going to be there. And lo and behold, the master does come to faith and agrees to let Richard Allen pay for his freedom. And so he works and he gets his freedom. So now that's a good story, right? It's revival, but now the revival's over and we're back to reality. And so Richard Allen is allowed to, as a black man, he's allowed to preach in the Methodist church, but usually during off hours or to other black people. So he has sort of a limited, but he does have some agency there. Eventually, though, St. George's will develop what's been known as the black pew, which a lot of churches did. In this particular case, it was the blacks had to sit in the balcony. And this famous story emerges where the white parishioners, the elders, the deacons, they tell the black people who are not sitting in the black section, you must leave. And this happens to Richard Allen's friend, Absalom Jones. Absalom Jones's famous line is say, brother, can't we at least finish the prayer? And they said, no, all the black people stand up, walk out of the church together in this act of solidarity. And within a couple of years, that same group of people are going to raise money to build their own church a couple miles away called Mother Bethel. And this will birth the first black denomination in America, the African Methodist Episcopal Church. And what you also see in this is that African Americans in this, now they have access to the gospel, but they have to adjudicate, how am I going to be treated and live in a church if I have to sit in the black pew? And what's remarkable is probably one of the most famous runaway slave abolitionist of the day, Frederick Douglass, also comes to faith in a Methodist church. And when he comes north, starts attending a Methodist church in Connecticut. But again, they have a black pew. And if you read Frederick Douglass's autobiography, he said, well, I'm willing to sit in the black pew because maybe they're not regenerated yet and they need to learn. He's like, after he was there for a couple months, he said, no, these people all think they are regenerated and I still have to sit in the black pew. And he left the Methodist church and started attending the AME church in Connecticut. And this AME church will actually morph into the South. And what's going to be absolutely fascinating, particularly for the way the gospel and this experience is going to also have political social ramifications, is that African Americans in the South, even some who are slaves who have a little bits of money or some freemen, they actually start to buy their own property in the South and build their own churches, AME churches in the South. And that just gives somebody who's all their agency's been taken from them, but they just own a small piece of real estate and they have a safe space where they can be. And it really does create this sort of abolitionist movement.
The gospel is not confined to a repentance and faith that have no connection with social and civil duties. The evangel of Christ is an all-embracing theme. The cross is the center of the spiritual and therefore of the material universe. Methodist Bishop Gilbert Haven.
A little over 100 years later, it's going to come out of the black church, the ultimate sort of ending of segregation in the 1960s in the church.
Yeah.
The creation of the black church is going to be the exact place where the leadership emerges, Martin Luther King Jr. and others, to lead this civil rights movement against still what's on the books legally in terms of segregation.
That's right.
So thinking about revivalism, sometimes it's where social hierarchy goes to die, but then, as you put it, it reemerges after the revival is over. True. But it creates new possibilities for the future. And I think this is one of those great possibilities. It takes a long time.
Let me tell another story where the social hierarchies changed. This is the William Wilberforce story. Methodist revivals in England. And here's a guy who's a member of parliament who is revived in his faith, is going to cause him to fight against slavery in the parliament. So now all of a sudden, this gospel that's starting in the fields and in churches is affecting people in parliament. And he is mentored by somebody who a lot of Christians may not know his name, but they've sung his song, Amazing Grace, John Newton. And John Newton's story is a classic Methodist revival change of heart story, where he was a slave ship captain, but just living a very debauched life. But he comes to faith and he's mentored by whom? George Whitefield and John Wesley. And he's mentored and eventually he will become a pastor and write songs like Amazing Grace. But he's also mentoring this young man who is a member of Parliament, William Wilberforce. And when Wilberforce finally wants to convict Parliament of their sin of slavery, who does he bring to the Parliament? But this old Anglican preacher who tells them everything that goes on in a slave ship and everything that goes on in slavery. And they're kind of looking at him cross-eyed saying, how do you know? And he's like, I did it. I was there. Haven't you sung my song? And so there's a case where what we're talking about, most of our listeners have probably sung Amazing Grace. Let that word wretch set in. When you think of what this revival in this period is doing, it's taking people who are debauched slavers and turning them into pastors who will spend their life ministering to people in poverty. But then God taking the least of these and walking them into Parliament. It's the equivalent of, you know, Paul, if Paul got his audience with the Caesar, walking into Parliament and being able to explain to them and show them the way the gospel changed this man and show them the evils of an institution. And within a couple months of his death, they actually banned the slave trade. And then Wilberforce continues his work and he lives to see it. And then eventually they will abolish slavery.
All these revivals end up creating something even bigger, which is a social reform movement. How do you make the land more holy? We've been talking about how do we become holy? Well, we can't on our own steam, but through Christ, Christ makes us holy. Okay, Mark, let's just spend a couple minutes dealing with some wayfinding cues that we take from the first and the second Great Awakening.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things just on the heels of the story of Whitefield and Newton and Wilberforce, there's a case where you're living out your convictions in society. Now, again, you're dealing with a Christian culture still, so Christians have political agency, but I don't think outside of the power of these revivals, you see a nation like England abolish slavery when they do. Of course, America's gonna have to fight a war to get it to happen. It's God's timetable. It's slow, it takes time. And maybe people are thinking, well, the revivals should have just made everybody abolitionists right there. But it didn't, including some of the people who were preaching. But it has this long-term effect and it just keeps perking and digging away and you just don't know what God is doing. And our job is to be faithful in the moment where we are, where God's called us to, such as a time as this. And God is working out, he is restoring his creation, he's restoring his people.
Yeah, it reminds you a lot of the book of Judges. The people are ebbing and flowing. Israel's ebbing and flowing. Historians, we call them declensions. What happens after the revival's over? Often the country enters into a time of declension, simply meaning a low period of Christian faithfulness and practice and those sorts of things. But in the midst of that flow, God's Spirit is reforming. That's one of the great takeaways, I think, from looking at these first and second Great Awakening experiences is that emergence of that.
I think you've kind of hit on this, Joe. We need to have a realistic understanding of what a revival is. It's not uncommon to grow up in the church and hear sermons, our nation needs revival. God, when are you going to pour out your spirit? And I think sometimes we have the idea that if we just had a revival, that somehow things would just be perfect. And I think what this study shows us is that's not how it works. You've done such a great job at saying, you know, 3 years, there's this energy, this, but then afterwards you have to sort it out. And just to realize that this is how God is working, how God has been working. So, you know, it's a plug for us. You need church historians to get this perspective.
Amen.
Yeah. But you might not get that from the preacher in the pulpit. He's doing his job. They're doing their job, preaching for revival. But it's not as if, oh, if we just had a revival, then all of a sudden all these problems would go away. No, but it will have an effect.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to our Wayfinding second part on revivalism. Please join us again as we delve deeper into a third episode of the continuation of revivalism in late 19th, early 20th century America, and also the global implications of that as revivalism pours out into the world. You can read Christian History Magazine, issue number 151, Awakenings, for free online at the link in the episode notes or purchase your print copy. Visit ChristianHistoryInstitute.org to sign up for your free first-year subscription to Christian History Magazine and find more resources on the history of our faith.